coming up.
How can it be that the Army is at war and the nation is not?
The military. What is it good for?
We have a military that's, A, very small, all volunteer, and relative to the size of the economy, relatively inexpensive. So it can be deployed without the civil society in whose name it fights breaking a sweat.
Has the all-volunteer army become an army of mercenaries?
We, comfortable members of the middle class, are in effect hiring some of our least advantaged fellow citizens to do some of our dirtiest work for us.
Should the draft be reinstated?
How many children of the 535 elected members of the United States Congress were in service? The answer is 10.
Is the concept of the citizen soldier an outmoded relic of a bygone era?
Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy.
I think we do have legitimate interests out there in the world, and on occasion we need force to secure those interests.
The military, what's it good for?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Look at that bunch of cows.
Not bunch, John, herd.
Herd of what?
Herd of cows.
Well, of course I've heard of cows.
No, a cow herd.
Well, what do I care what a cow herd? I've got no secrets from cows.
But it's no secret that Philosophy Talk depends on donations from our listeners to help keep us on the air. So go make your donation at philosophytalk.org now.
And question everything.
Except if you heard it from a cow. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
We're continuing conversations that began at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. And our conversation today is about the military, and we're asking, what is it good for?
Well, Ken, I got a Swiss Army knife, so even Switzerland needs an army. Clearly, a vast and populous nation like ours has to have a military.
But even if we take it as granted, John, that any nation, most especially a nation that wants to be a significant player on the world stage, is going to have a military of some sort, that still leaves lots of questions open.
What kind of military should we have exactly? Maybe a compact military that will deal with homeland defense, but nothing else?
Or a large, robust force capable of projecting power around the globe.
And who should serve in the military? Should all able-bodied citizens be compelled to serve? Or should we leave it up to volunteers?
To whom should the military be accountable? And how exactly can it be held to account? And do we civilians owe our military leaders a high degree of deference?
It's kind of like Goldilocks' problem. If the military is too big and powerful, if civilian authorities show it too much respect, then there's a real danger of militarism.
But if the military is too small, and if it has too little influence over decision-making by civilian leaders, well, that can lead to disaster, too.
So we need a military that's just the right size, that strikes just the right balance between deference and accountability.
Striking that delicate balance, John, that sounds like a hard job. But it sounds like a job for some wise policymakers. What are a couple of philosophers like us doing worrying about the military and its role in public life?
Well, now, there's a dangerous path to go down. But I guess the answer is that, look, I mean, we as a democracy collectively decide about the proper role, size, composition, and degree and accountability of the armed services. It goes to the very heart of our democracy, and philosophers like everyone else should think about it.
Are we going to be a society where the military functions as an instrument of the will of the people at large?
Or a society where the military functions as a special class unto itself with its own agenda? And no one, except maybe a narrow civilian elite, knows what's going on.
If we are to remain a true democracy, we can't afford to leave these questions to the military, nor even just to our elected leaders. We all have a vital stake in them.
Now, one way to make people fully own up to their responsibilities here is to go back to having a draft.
That's a point there. I mean, if military service were compulsive and universal, certainly, without a doubt, the general population would feel a more visceral personal stake in deciding what use the military is put to.
And that might make it harder for politicians and generals to persuade us to spend our treasure and spill our blood on fool's errands, not to mention any in particular, in the first place.
Well, you know, that's part of what drove Nixon to end the draft, I think. He ended the draft not because he was a liberal do-gooder, but because he wanted a freer hand to conduct the war in Vietnam as he pleased.
He realized that if it's my blood or the blood of my loved ones that's going to be involved, I might stand up and protest, particularly if I think it's a silly war and the blood is spilled in vain.
And if it's only the blood of the already willing that's being spilled, even if it's being spilled in vain, there's bound to be less hue and cry.
Putting Nixon's self-interested political calculations aside, though, a voluntary army, an army of the willing, seems like a good thing, not a bad thing. Sometimes a nation may legitimately have to wage a war of a somewhat morally ambiguous character, in which the clean and decisive outcome is far from assured. Why should we force unwilling conscripts to fight and die in that kind of a situation?
Shared burdens, John. I mean, sometimes you have to share in the burdens of nationhood, even if you don't want to. Look, nobody likes to pay taxes. Nobody. But we don't say, well, let's tax only the willing. Leave it to the willing. This is the same with military service.
Well, sometimes the willing really aren't so willing after all. You don't see that many wealthy or upper middle class kids. Kids that went to Stanford or other elite places, or people that have great jobs, you don't see those people volunteering to be on active duty.
These are complicated issues, and I think there's a lot to talk about.
To make our discussions more fruitful, we'll be joined by someone who provides a broad historical perspective on the military and what it's good for.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy, author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War. He'll join us in a little bit.
We'd also like the perspective of our live audience here at the Marsh.
But first, a roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, talks to a Vietnam veteran who went through the draft process. She files this report.
The Draft Lottery, a live report on tonight's picking of the birth dates for the draft. Here at Selective Service Headquarters in Washington.
Of the troops fighting in the Vietnam War, 25% were drafted.
Good evening. It was 29 years ago that the first and most famous lottery number, 158, was drawn as the United States entered World War II.
My draft number was 127 out of 365.
Rick Collins works at the VA Center in Oakland, California. He was in his 20s when he went before the draft board back in 1970.
Well, they went the whole thing about wanted to know what I did and letting me know that they were ready to make me 1A so that I could serve my country. And they were going through all types of machinations to try to make me feel uncomfortable. None of the people out there looked like my neighbors except for one guy. They were mostly older white guys, and they were the ones who were making the decisions.
Collins is African American. He grew up in a working class neighborhood in Philadelphia. He says, standing before the draft board, he felt like his life was in their hands.
Well, nobody fled to Canada from my neighborhood.
Where Collins grew up, military service was an honorable profession. His father was in the military.
Most of the people in my neighborhood were in the military. They were either drafted or they enlisted to get ahead of the draft, to have some choice about what service they went into.
So in the end, Collins volunteered. He had a commission to serve as a social worker, counseling soldiers fighting in Vietnam, many of whom were severely traumatized by the war. He says when he was young, he didn't really think twice about the draft.
Getting drafted was a rite of passage for most of the young men in the area.
Collins says some of the old-timers who were drafted in earlier wars want to see the draft reinstated. They say it inspires patriotism, and there's something to the idea that every citizen should carry the burden of protecting a country. But Collins says he doesn't think it could ever work in this society, in part because we no longer feel threatened.
When we had the draft before, World War II, there was obviously a threat. And then we had the threat of worldwide communism. That doesn't exist now, which is why just about all of America's allies have gotten rid of the draft.
And without a threat, there's no real motivation.
I don't get the sense that there was this feeling of everybody wanting to pitch in or everybody needing to pitch in.
Even though fewer and fewer Americans have any connection to the military, Collins believes societal attitudes are shifting again towards support of veterans, not an attitude he saw much of during his youth.
I can remember from Vietnam down to when I was mobilized during Desert Storm, there was a whole sort of change where people had actually called me a baby killer during the time I was in the military. But I can remember after Desert Storm, people would walk up and shake your hand and want to talk to you. And if you made the mistake and went to a bar in uniform when you're someplace else on a mission, then people would want to buy a drink and stuff like that.
Collins prefers a volunteer army because he believes people who want to be there will do a better job. And as long as Americans support their veterans, people will want to serve. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by David Kennedy. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. David, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
David, you're a historian by trade. You wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the Depression, World War II, but lately your attention has turned to the military. You've edited this volume of Daedalus, bringing together lots of heavy thinkers about the modern American military. How did this happen? How did your interest turn in that direction? You come from a long line of soldiers, maybe?
No, there's a few soldiers in my family background, and sailors too, but not in my immediate family. Of course, I've written about World War II, and for that matter, World War I, and you can't really write about those topics without engaging something, saying something about the military. But more immediately, I was teaching a course at Stanford a half dozen years ago or so, and I gave a lecture about how history might predict the American future in some ways, and I touched on the military. And there was a woman, an auditor in the course. She was the spouse of a national security fellow at the Hoover Institution, and she challenged me to be more forthcoming about that. So I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about this matter, and that led to various things, including the volume of Daedalus that you've just referred to.
Okay, well, you've given it a lot of thought, so let's ask the question that Ken and I ask. Our military, why do we have it, and is it too small, too big, or just right?
Well, those are two different questions, I'd say.
Why
do we have it at all? I think Ken correctly observed, or maybe it was you, there are very few of any countries in the world that don't have a military. Costa Rica, I think, is the example that comes to mind, but it is an exception. Even Switzerland, you might say, which has pretty good national security guarantees by its topography, has an army. Why does any country have an army? To defend its interests in this fallen, imperfect world of ours, where occasionally it's necessary to rely on force, or to assert its interests, which is a somewhat different matter.
Well, that's a very different matter. Asserting one's interests sounds a little possibly imperial, but let's go to the size. Too big, too small, just right.
Well, let's talk about the size. If we talk about the characteristics of today's United States Armed Forces, it has some very salient characteristics that we need to keep in mind in any discussion like this. One of them you've already dwelled on. It's an all-volunteer force. That's actually not new in our history, but it's new in the post-World War II period. But it's an all-volunteer force, and one of its obvious characteristics is that it's relatively small. About 1.5 million people in the active duty armed services today. In World War II, just to put it in perspective, we mobilized 16 million men in uniform in a population of about 135, 140 million. So it was an 11 or 12% of the population served in uniform. Today it's less than 0.5%.
But
so we have a very small force.
That was to fight the fascists marauding over Europe and the Japanese marauding over Asia and having attacked our own homeland in the Pacific.
Exactly. It was a different kind of war. A war, frankly, I think we'll never see again in anybody's lifetime now listening to this program, where you had two or more big industrial states mobilized right down to the basis of their economy in what amounts to a war of attrition in which the biggest industrial power eventually wins. That is the logic of those kinds of wars.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing the military and asking, what is it good for? With Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy.
In whose interest should the military function, and to whom should it be held accountable? Should all able-bodied citizens be forced to serve in the military, or should it just be left to volunteers? How much deference should we ordinary citizens pay to the judgments of our military leaders?
Who serves? Who decides? Along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Down the old buildings and show us the way. Yeah.
Thanks to our musical guests, Merle Kessler and Joshua Raul Brody. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the military. What is it good for? With Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy.
Should all able-bodied citizens be forced to serve in the military, or should the burdens fall only on the willing, the volunteers? Is the military really answerable to the people at large, or is the military class a class unto itself, answerable only to a narrow elite? How big and fancy of an armed services do we really need? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, David, I want to get to this issue of the proper size of the military and what it's for. But before that, I want to get back to the issue our roving philosophical reporter was talking about. Let's start with the draft, then. I mean, I know that there are lots of people in and out of the military. They won't say it out loud so much. But in their hearts of hearts, they think a draft, a return to the draft, would be a very good thing. Not just for the military, but for society at large. What do you think?
Well, I think most of the professional military actually do not want a draft. They think the all-volunteer service is a much more manageable service for reasons that were alluded to earlier, that there are fewer discipline problems because people are there voluntarily and so on and so forth. So there's, and people can be held in service longer, they can be trained to a higher level of proficiency. So the military itself has come to really love the idea of the all-volunteer force. However, there's also anxiety even amongst the professional military about the increasing detachment between the military as an institution in our society and the civil society in whose name it fights. And for reasons that we alluded to just a few minutes ago about the relative demographic size of the force, a very small portion of the population, there's another factor. Despite the very large absolute numbers of the Pentagon's budget today, roughly $700 billion, that's only about 5% of GDP. In World War II, it was 40%. In the Cold War, it was in the 8 to 10% range. So we have a military that's, A, very small, all volunteer, very small, and relative to the size of the economy, relatively inexpensive. So it can be deployed without the civil society in whose name it fights breaking a sweat. I think that's a very difficult, dangerous
matter. But isn't our military budget essentially bigger than the rest of the world combined?
It's roughly equal to the rest of the world's military budget.
So it's a bit odd to say small.
It's small relative to the size of our economy, mm-hmm. and it's small relative to the claim of the military on this economy's resources in the Cold War period and in World War II.
Okay, I want to get back to the size is one thing, but again, I want to talk about the composition, the all-volunteer army. I think you said something really important, that there's a relative detachment between the military and the civil society in whose name it supposedly acts. Yeah. Once it's detached like that, it's less answerable. Moreover, I've read stuff, and getting ready for the show, I've read a fair amount of stuff, and there are people who give something like the following argument. One of the things that universal conscription would do, and one of the things that the ending of conscription did, it changed the very character of citizenship. Citizens now think of themselves as entitled to things from the government, right? We are entitlements, rights-based citizens. Rather than an obligation-based citizenry. What do we owe? John Kennedy asked. That's not what your country can do for you. That's what you can do for your country. That would sound so weird to people these days. People aren't asked to serve their country. And the draft was this thing that is the school of nationhood, one of these articles said. The military functioned as, when there was a draft, functioned as a way of making the nation one, as shared obligations, shared burdens, even if they're unpleasant burdens. Well, what do you think about that argument?
Well, I agree with you. I think that military service has been one of the means for a long, long time, for a century and more, by which people were made to understand their connection with their fellow citizens and their membership in the national community. The size and nature of the military we have today essentially negates that function or doesn't allow it to happen. This relationship between citizenship and service is, I think, really fascinating. About the only obligation of citizenship that's left in our society today is jury service. There's virtually nothing else that a citizen is obligated to do, or that only citizens are obligated to do. The Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, changed the rules so that aliens, that is non-citizens, who served in the U.S. military could be fast-tracked for citizenship. So they essentially said, you can earn citizenship through military service, and yet if you're a citizen, you're not obligated to military service. That's an asymmetry, and I think is really pretty odd.
But, I mean, what Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. If you think about it, that's bizarre. I mean, we've got a country, we pay taxes, it should be doing something for us. I mean, I don't need to ask what I can do for my country. I'm sure if they have something in mind for me to do, they'll send me a bill or. But what we ought to be demanding is our country ought to be doing something for us. So
you really think so? I mean, look, I mean, I agree that the country owes us things. It owes us the protection of our rights and privileges. The immunities and privileges of the United States, of the citizens of the United States, shall not be abridged, the 14th Amendment says, right? And that's a grand thing. That's a really grand thing. But it's not just a one, is it really just a one-way street? When we bind together to make a collectivity, a nation, and we're one thing, and there are unpleasant things that have to be done, I mean, why do we say, why? I mean, what's wrong with saying it's part of the price of citizenship in this grand collectivity?
But what's wrong with it is you go back and look what Kennedy historically turned out to have in mind. Let's invade Cuba. Let's start the Vietnam War. I mean, we would have been much better off if everybody said to him, don't ask us to do anything, because what you'll ask us to do is stupid.
But those kinds of decisions to stupidly deploy the military are easier, it seems to me, in a system where the military is all volunteer and small and relatively inexpensive. All citizens are at least exposed to the possibility of military service. You've got built into the nature of things and a political constraint on the decision to shoulder arms.
Okay, but just a small point. Now, we're moving now towards a military where most of our important objectives are going to be done by drones. Are we going to get to a point where nobody, I mean, you barely even find out in the news what these drones are doing and what they're killing? Are we moving in the opposite direction of what would make sense from the point of view of having the military more integrated?
Well, the drones aren't yet wholly autonomous. They do have human operators, so there's still human beings involved in the equation. But let me share with you an anecdote that I heard. I was an observer at the United States Army ROTC encampment at Fort Lewis, Washington about 4 years ago. 6,000 and some cadets come there for training for a 5-week period in the summer. And repeatedly, the officers who were running the program asked the rhetorical question of me, how can it be that the Army is at war and the nation is not? And there it is. That encapsulates the whole thing. The relative insularity of the Army and the military from the rest of us is a worrisome matter. And I'll put some numbers to this. At that time, there were 305 general officers in the United States Army. And they told me that amongst the 305 of them, brigadier general and above, they had 180 of their children in service. And they referred to this with a mixture of anxiety and pride as the family business. Okay. Intergenerational insularity of the military from the rest of the society. So I came home and I had my research assistant go to work on how many children of the 535 elected members of the United States Congress were in service. The answer is 10.
Yeah, right, exactly. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the military and asking, what is it good for? In front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we have questions from that live audience. I'll start on this side of the room and I'll go back and forth. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and where you're from and what your question is.
Hi, my name is Drew. I'm from San Francisco. And so you've been talking about the potential or the history of the draft as something that might have shared the burden of military service. My father was drafted during the Vietnam War and served in the military, and I grew up thinking this was pretty common for men of his generation. And as I've grown up and talked to people my age, I find it's very rare. In fact, I can't think of one friend of mine whose father also served in the military. And that this might reflect a certain demographic, but clearly people were getting exemptions. So I was wondering if you could maybe speak to the history of that, and would there be, you know, if we talk theoretically about reinstituting a draft, are there reforms that could be made to actually share the burden equitably?
Yeah, that's a perfect question for you.
Well, let me say, first of all, we do not need, for strictly military purposes, nor would we know what to do with a draft army on the scale of the Vietnam era, and certainly not the World War II era. We've found ways to do our military business more efficiently. We don't need those gigantic forces that we once had. You're also absolutely right, Drew, that in the Vietnam era, particularly in the early years of the Vietnam era, the force was very unrepresentative of the population at large. There were disproportionate numbers of African Americans in the force and so on and so forth. That was gradually corrected over time as various kinds of deferments were reduced or eliminated, like fathers were exempted at first, then they weren't, and students lost their deferments at a certain point. So the system gradually became more fair and equitable and defensible, but it had big inequities built into it at the first.
There's no doubt about that. But again, the size of the military that we need is a complicated thing because, you know, in some ways we kind of disguise the smallness of our active duty force by rotating people out of the reserves and all this stuff. And I mean, I know a guy who's on his second tour of duty in Iraq, right? And we may not need a military the size of the one that stood off the Soviets in the Cold War or helped defeat the Nazis with the aid of those same Soviets, right? At whom Hitler threw 17 divisions and all that. We may not need
more, more like 300 divisions.
Was it? but we may not need a military like that. But it seems like we probably need a military larger than the one we have.
Well, we have actually a military that, in effect, is larger than the official one
right.
We have, thanks to the use of contractors.
Right.
And in fact, one of the authors, or a pair of authors in this volume of Daedalus that you referred to that I edited on the modern American military, documents that at the height of the Iraq War, we had more contractors in country than we had uniformed personnel. So that's another way that masked might be a little too strong, but at least the actual number of troops is obscured by the configuration.
I'm going to say a word that isn't true of our military, but, you know, you're making it sound more like a mercenary army than an army of the people, right? Because we pay these people who have no particular stake in our national lives, but they're just doing it for pay. I mean, we don't want a mercenary army, do we?
Well, in the opinion piece of the New York Times that I referred to, I used the word mercenary in the first paragraph, and that produced more blowback from the world out there than anything I've ever written in any newspaper or magazine or what have you. So I think we want to be really careful about that word. It has a very negative connotation. And its strict definition is usually hiring people from outside your body politic to do the fighting for you. There's some of that in the current force. But this is just impressionistic, but when I encounter today's uniformed military personnel, most of them are there for idealistic reasons. They believe in service. They believe in country. They use a language of service in this unapologetic way like you don't hear in civil society.
But look, the size of the military we need depends on what we're going to do with it. Now, you've written books on World War I and World War II, and I know historians don't like to think about counterfactuals if somebody else poses them, but surely you must admit that we'd all be better off if Woodrow Wilson had never got us into World War I. I mean, the reason we think we need a big military is we're still involved in his business of making the world safe for democracy. If we just worried about keeping the hordes off our oceans, we wouldn't need a big military at all. Don't you agree?
No. I don't agree with your characterization of Woodrow Wilson to start with. I think we do have legitimate interests out there in the world, and on occasion we need force in order to secure those interests.
Let's take more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Edward. I'm from San Francisco. I was in the first lottery, and my number was 196, and they called up to 195, so I was one of those lucky ones. I knew some people who were drafted and went. I knew some people who served voluntarily. I knew people who went to Canada. I knew people who ended up going to jail. And I guess I have a lot of respect for all of those positions, and I am very thankful I didn't have to pick one of them. But we do have, in our society, the head of the military is a civilian. The commander-in-chief is a civilian. And I think that's very important. So while I do think we do owe respect to our military, it's very important for us as citizens to make sure that they're used wisely. And I guess it's kind of a little bit of a contradiction in the sense that the military does need that chain of command in order to function. So they have to do what they're told, but we got to be very careful what we tell them. So I'm not sure that was a question, but I appreciate your time.
Well, I think this is a really important question. I think we need to hold the military accountable, and we need to defer to the military when it's right to defer. And it seems to me like a really delicate thing.
Well, Edward, you remind me that I used a remark or a maxim from Cicero, actually, as the frontispiece and epigraph for this volume I just edited of Daedalus. And it reads, arms are of little value in the field unless there is wise counsel at home. I mean, there goes to the crux of the matter, it seems to me, between these questions of accountability, relation of the military to civil society, and the command structure. And yes, you're absolutely right. I think we have had reasonably responsible civilian exercise of authority over the military. On the other hand, the nature of the force we have creates political space for the political class, the leadership, the civilian leadership class, to use the military without really consulting the public at large or imposing any particular burdens.
So here's another argument for the draft. John said it was bad. The draft's a bad thing because, you know, people get all stirred up. The draft constrains politicians in the military class and their use of the military. If it's our blood that is going to be spilled, and it's spilled without my consent, but I have to serve, then that's going to make my parents, my loved one, that's going to stir them up and mobilize them and force them to reflect, is this really worth it? And do I really stand for it?
That's right.
So I think that's the draft is a powerful thing in that way.
Well, there may be other ways to accomplish that objective. For example, in the immediate post-Vietnam era, 1973, when we went to the all-volunteer force, the military put in place something called the Total Force Doctrine, capital D, capital F, capital D. And its essence was to make it necessary, absolutely necessary, to call up the reserves for any deployment above a certain threshold size and projected duration. What was the political logic of this? It made it necessary to reach into civilian communities,
right,
and extract people from their jobs and families in order to undertake a major deployment. We now have a military that doesn't need very many reserves, and indeed Secretary Rumsfeld tried to institute a policy called rebalancing, which was to do away with the total force doctrine and make the active duty force fully sufficient and deployable without calling up the reserves, yet weakening yet further the link between civil society and the military.
You know, there's another side to it, Ken, which is cognitive dissonance. That is, once you've done something, particularly if it's costly, you tend to think it must have been good reasons that led you there. And when you have a large part of the population that's been involved in a war, you have a big basis for this kind of self-delusion about how good the war was. So one bright aspect of having a small military is we'll have less people invested in retroactively justifying the war.
Well, maybe.
Whatever.
I think it depends on the outcome of the military exercise. If it's judged to be successful, the public at large might think, well, that was easy. We didn't have to pay any more taxes. We didn't have to send our sons and daughters in voluntarily. We got a big victory.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, the military, what is it good for? With Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy.
In our final segment, we're going to talk about reforming the military. What changes need to be made in the way our armed services are staffed, deployed, and governed?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Go and jump, bold son, off the roof. Go and bake yourself in a stew. All the pain you feel is the proof that the economy is watching you. Every billionaire depends on you.
Let's hear it for our live musical guests, Merle Kessler and Joshua Raoul Brody. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the military and asking, what is it good for, with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy. And we've got questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thanks. My name is Matthew. I'm from San Francisco. My question is, when should civilian political leaders defer to military leadership, and when should the military leadership defer to the political leaders? And in this era of more sort of diffuse, low-intensity conflicts, is that becoming more clouded?
David.
Well, the Constitution provides an answer to that question, Matthew. The military is decidedly and constitutionally obligated to be subordinate to civilian leadership, and I think that's a really sound principle that we should reaffirm in every possible way. In the 1980s, there was a piece of legislation passed called Goldwater-Nichols Act, which actually rearranged the way that the military can give advice to the civilian leadership, to the president in particular, but it did not rearrange the chain of command. The commander-in-chief remains the civilian authority responsible for the military.
Grant that, but let's take Iraq. Rumsfeld had this view about the size of the force that could get and how quickly, and I have a very close friend who's in the military and was in Iraq at the time, and one of the things he said was, we didn't send enough forces over there. We didn't send enough forces so that we could lock down the place and say, you don't move unless I say you move. And he says that made it much worse. And these guys in the Defense Department thought they knew. The military all knew this, right? So I agree about the chain of the command, but isn't there something to be said for listening to the guys who have to actually carry out the thing?
Well, they did listen and dismissed what they heard by and large. The one person who said very clearly that they needed a larger force was General Shinoseki, and they canned
it. They fired him.
So that's one of the prices you pay for civilian control of the military, is that they're free to ignore the advice they get.
But
the alternative is to put the military in control of all military decisions. I don't think we want to go there.
No, that's a bad thing.
No one wants to do that. But to what extent does the civilian leadership have the right to keep information, or at least opinions, of the military away from the public? I mean, I guess that goes back to Truman and MacArthur. I mean, should the public have the right to know what General MacArthur thinks ought to be done, or should they only hear MacArthur's view if Truman approves of it?
Well, I think there are practical limits on the transparency of the advice that the military gives to the president or the civilian leadership. I mean, there are matters of intelligence and so on that ought to be privileged, I think, properly so. But the ultimate rationale for the decision to shoulder arms, to go into the field armed, it must be transparent to the public to the maximum degree possible. I think our current situation actually constricts the opportunity for the political leadership to be as transparent with the public as I think it ideally should be.
Let's take one question from this side of the room.
Hi, my name is Robin, and I'm from Daly City. And my question is about, we've been using terms like willing and volunteer, but what about economic compulsion? What is the level of our current military that feel like they have to go into it for economic reasons, and how does that work in a democracy when we're sort of putting the burden on those folks who can't afford to do anything else?
Well, Rama, you're putting your finger on something that is, unfortunately, a conspicuous feature of current recruiting. Secretary Gates talked about this last spring at a speech at Duke University about how the force is disproportionately recruited from the southeastern and Rocky Mountain states. It's also disproportionately recruited from rural counties. And it is quite clear, I think, in the data that we are recruiting the force by and large from the least privileged sectors of our society. That's not universally true, but it's heavily true.
So that can't be a good thing.
No, I think we comfortable members of the middle class, more or less, are in effect hiring some of our least advantaged fellow citizens to do some of our dirtiest work for us.
I don't want to say the dirty word, but it's like we, the privileged elite, are happy with, it's not a mercenary force because it's drawn from our populace, our citizens, but we're happy with those folks being paid to do the job, right? And that goes back to, and I still think that sort of dissolves the bonds of mutual citizenship, mutual burdens.
Yeah, but I mean, that's all true, and I can see it's a bad thing, but on the other hand, it's another way of saying that a certain part of the populace will see military service as, on the whole, a good thing. It's a nice opportunity, apparently, or people wouldn't do it. I mean, some of these people wouldn't get educated, wouldn't have a board and room, wouldn't have anything. So it's not so obvious that it's if the military was attractive to philosophy PhDs and MBAs, we think something's screwy.
Well, it might be attractive to philosophy PhDs because they have a hard time getting done. But I'm going to do a little thought experiment, David. I'm going to make you, David Kennedy, the commander-in-chief of the military for a day with plenary power so that you can do exactly what you want. You don't have to answer to anybody, but your job is to perfect the military. What would you do?
Well, I don't like the premise of the question because it implies we're in a military dictatorship, but okay.
This is a thought experiment.
I'll go along with the premise.
Leaving that a detail aside,
It's only for a day, and you have to perfect the military. If after you're done you don't perfect the military, we put you to death. Okay?
All right, well, Rome wasn't built in a day, and the military is not going to be perfected in a single day, but I think it could be improved by some of the following devices. And by the improvement that I would try to affect the military is in two dimensions. Making it more accountable to the political system as a whole, especially to citizen understanding and input, and making it more fair and equitable in service. Okay, so to those ends, I would do three things if I had this 24-hour slot and I could just do it. Okay, one is I would restore the total force doctrine that was put in place in the 1970s so that, in fact, if a large-scale force had to be deployed for a long period of time, it would be obligatory to call up the reserves, disrupt civilian communities. That raises the threshold for demonstrating that there is a compelling reason to go to war. That's number one. Number two, I would do what actually is happening to a certain degree on my campus at Stanford and others around the country at so-called elite institutions where ROTC has been absent for a long generation. I would bring it back as another way of interdigitating people who are likely to become leaders in the civilian sector with the military so they understand each other, and there's just more integument and more connection amongst those two sectors in our society. That's number two. Number three, and this goes especially to the business of equity and burden sharing across the population as a whole, making this force more representative. I will not go as far as imposing obligatory military service, but I think some version of the lottery that was around at the very end of the Vietnam era might do a lot to make the public at large, the civilian public, pay attention to who serves the military and what the military does.
Another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pam.
My name is Monique, and I live in Daly City. And my question, I agree with the premise that the shared burden and having obligations as a citizen and so on. My question is, do you think it might not be accomplished by other things, by Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, in Cuba, all high school students had to quit school for a year and eliminate literacy in 1 year. In Israel is a smaller country, so it's easy to have compulsory military service, but are there other options in your opinion?
So, Commander-in-Chief with plenary powers, you're going to accept that as a friendly
I thought
amendment?
This 24-hour period had expired by now.
All right. You're going to accept that as
so
an
I'm
amendment?
I'm still in the hot seat. Well, look, you may have noticed in the things that I suggested, my big three reforms, there was nothing compulsory about any of them. And when you say compulsory, obligatory, required, have to serve, had to serve, that's where I get off the train. I think I have just enough of a libertarian streak in me that I think that absent a truly compelling threat to our national existence, the state does not have the right to require service of the most dangerous possibly
mortal. So what is this lottery? What do the winners of this lottery have to do?
It introduces an element of this, to be sure. You're right to identify that. But it does spread the risk of such service across the broadest possible cohort. And it is the risk of service rather than actual service that I think serves to concentrate the mind of the public at large on what it is the military is doing and how it's being used.
I don't know what I feel in my heart of hearts about compulsory military service. I'm pretty happy that I never had to do that, I think. You know, especially during the Vietnam era toward the end of which I was of age. But still, it seems to me that your argument's a little odd.
Not for the first time.
I want to ask, what is a state? A state is a collectivity of us. For common purposes. It's not just a thing from which you get things, and it's not just something you say, well, I have the right to be left alone by that state. Well, you entered into the state as a common undertaking, and when the state has this burden that it discharges in the name of us, defense of the state, I don't see an argument why the state does not have the legitimate power to compel those who entered into this collectivity to serve it. I don't see why the state should not have, and it seems to me a fully legitimate power. And moreover, if the state has a high burden, because it compels you, it has a high burden of justifying to you and not just to some special class, that seems to me, you know, it seems to be an important thing.
Well, you'll note in the program I outlined, I did allow for compulsory national service in the face of a threat, an existential threat,
right,
to deep, 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 deep security interests or indeed the very survival of the nation. So I'm certainly willing to carve out that kind of an exception. But in ordinary, let's say, peacetime circumstances, am I willing to concede to the state the right to compel me or my sons and daughters or grandchildren to actually serve in some capacity, whether it's Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, or what have you, as well as the military? I'm just not prepared to go that far.
What do you think, John?
I was going to say, how about in the Civil War, as I understand it, there was a draft, but you could buy your way out of it, not the way maybe people did in Vietnam, dishonestly or behind, but, you know, actually just pay up front and you didn't have to be drafted. What do you think about that?
Well, lots of countries that have compulsory military service still, like Turkey. My student from Turkey said, well, I can just get somebody to serve that for me.
Well, Turkey still has a pretty formidable draft system, actually. I'm not sure. I don't know the details, but I'm not sure about that. Well, John, you're right. In the Civil War, that is among the reasons why, at a certain point, not least among the Irish in New York and the famous draft riots in the middle of the war, it was called a rich man's war and a poor man's fight because the rich could buy their way out of service. Not all did, but many did. We had de facto the same kind of exemption mechanism. It wasn't cash on the barrelhead, but it was the same, it had the same purpose or same result in the Vietnam era, where if you stayed in school or you got married or you had a kid, there are all kinds of ways to do this. There was a famous story in World War II, despite a lot of mythology. In fact, most troops who served in World War II were drafted, not volunteers. And there's a famous anecdote about a guy who had a couple, married couple who had a child in the early phase of World War II. and they named him Weatherstrip because he kept his father out of the draft.
Well, on that note, David, it's getting time. Thank you for joining us. But if you have one last comment, I'll give you time for
I do have one last comment that I just happened to bring with me here. And it takes us back to another president, not John F. Kennedy, but George Washington, who said the following in 1783. It may be laid down as a primary position and the basis of our system that every citizen who enjoys the protection of a free government owes not only a proportion of his property, but even of his personal services to the defense of it.
On that note, thank you for joining us. Our guest has been David Kennedy. He's a professor of history from Stanford University, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945.
And we also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, what are you thinking today? Have you changed your mind about anything here?
No, not really. I mean, it's fine to talk about the state and its interests and all that, but when it comes down to you have, you know, one group of idiots that managed to get elected by buying a lot of votes, insisting that somebody go to the far ends of the earth and risk getting killed for them. And I'm cynical about the whole thing. I hope that didn't show out too much.
Well, you know, I really don't know what I think about this, but I do think a big thing happened, and Vietnam was a huge watershed. I think we stopped trusting our national leaders to use resources wisely, so we weren't willing to give them the kind of command over us, right? And I think we've gotten over that somewhat, but I don't think we've gotten over that totally, and I think Iraq was a misadventure in many different ways that sort of re-brought in this, we don't trust these guys. But when you have a polity where the people don't trust the leaders, that's a bad thing. That's a tough thing.
At the beginning of the Vietnam War, I was a student, and I also had a child, and I was married, but I was ready to volunteer, and my wife, bless her heart, told me she'd shoot me. 2 years later, I had become one of these people who had just completely reformulated what I thought of our national leadership, and I have seen no reason to change my mind since.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we enlist Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher. He reports for duty.
Ian Scholes, the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Now, this has always puzzled me. We have a lot of guns floating around, but where exactly is that well-regulated militia? Ever since the Militia Act of 1903, all able-bodied men between the ages of 17 and 45, not presently in military service, are part of the reserve militia, a kind of incipient militia that could achieve actuality at the whim of the federal government. Unlike the Minutemen of the American Revolution, however, if drafted, I don't think we'd be expected to bring our own guns to the fight. That .22 in the closet just doesn't have the stopping power. There have been many militias in our history. Real, actual U.S. militias stood at the border of what is now Utah back in the 1850s in what could have been a real, actual us versus Mormon war. But then the Civil War happened and the us backed down. Real actual militias were used in the early 20th century to bust unions, and there are merely roving armed guerrillas as well, pro-union Jayhawkers in Kansas in the 1850s, and their counterparts, Quantrill's Raiders and the men who rode with Buddy Bill Anderson, who was himself killed by actual union militia in 1864. And there was a militia movement, many militia movements in the late 20th century, the Freemen, the Black Panthers, the Branch Davidians, Posse Comitatus, showdowns at Ruby Ridge and Waco. The militia movements have kind of waned in the 21st century as more and more people realize it's probably not a good idea to point loaded weapons at federal officers. The Tea Party could be considered a kind of unarmed militia, I suppose, though many of them are packing. Some Tea Partiers are part of the open carry movement as well, with members carrying pistols openly into coffee shops to make a point. In California, it is legal to carry a weapon openly so long as it's not loaded, which kind of defeats the purpose of displaying a weapon, doesn't it? Why not just take a picture of the pistol and tape it to your shirt? At any rate, I have concluded that gun attitudes are a country versus city thing. In the country, a gun is just a tool, like a power drill or saw. In the city, it's a murder weapon. And of course, American militias first began in the country, citizens getting together to defend against Indians, bandits, and, I don't know, the French. In the city, you just call the cops. In the city, roving bands of armed men would be considered alarming. unless they're well-regulated, of course, and totally necessary to the security of a free state, and if they get their coffee to go, please. That bristling weaponry is making the baristas nervous. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demeris. Music from Merle Kessler and Joshua Raul Brody.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski, Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.